Oh, man. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. The Daily Caller Podcast for the first day of August 2019. The rent is due. The rent is due today. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Thanks for all that good stuff that you guys are doing to spread the word of the program. I literally couldn't do it without you. I mean, I could, but it would suck. And you guys make my life better. So thank you for all of that. We got another debate. Holy Frank Tanana. We're going to get to all of that. We've got the highlights and the analysis that you crave and all the mockery that this deserves. Jeez, you can email me, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. That goes right to me. I will get to your emails sooner rather than later, so don't worry if you haven't heard back from me. Like I said, tons of stuff that happened in that debate. But first, I want to tell you about our new sponsor, Life Change Tea. Yes, that's right. It's a game changer. Since I've been drinking Life Change Tea, I've noticed that I'm feeling so much better. And I can tell you how much more energy I have. I don't know if you've noticed it in the show, but I got a little more pep in my step. How does it work? Life Change Tea is a proprietary herbal formula, gentle daily cleanse designed to rid your body of harmful intruders. Yes, it's a cleanse. It gets you going so you can get going in the day. Let's face it, our food was different 60 years ago, minimally processed, free of pesticides, nourishing, healthy for your body. Today, not so much. GMOs, pesticides, herbicides, all the processing, they've depleted some of the nutrition from our food. No wonder you feel so run down. You got to get that stuff out of your body. And there's how you do it. Try it for yourself. Go to getthetea.com now. That's one word, getthetea.com. Get ready for more energy. Drink it every day. Life Change Tea is not available in stores. Go to getthetea.com. You help this program and you help yourself. I wouldn't tell you if it wasn't true. Tastes good too. That's getthetea.com. And you know me, I'm not a coffee drinker. Coffee is, ugh. This tea is awesome. And it makes a difference. Puts a little pep in your step once you get that stuff out of you. Okay, speaking of getting stuff out of you, good Lord, the Democrats up on the stage could have used some of this tea, some of this Life Change Tea, because they were a little stopped up. They were full of it, shall we say. Where to begin and how to start? Joe Biden, good Lord. He had more energy. I got to give Joe props. Joe Biden, the former vice president of the United States, did have more energy today than he had, or yesterday, than he had in the last debate. Which isn't saying a whole lot, if you're really being honest with yourself, because he was barely at about 40 beats per minute on his heart rate in the last debate. This time, he showed up and stayed awake. I don't know what they did to him. They gave him the double caffeinated espresso, or they gave him a bump of blow behind the scenes. I don't know what it was, but he was certainly there this time, mostly. I mean, mentally, it's still Joe Biden, and Joe Biden has some problems. As a matter of fact, just for fun, I love these things that come out of the debates. The guys who work in video and capture the video and have it, you're watching the debate, and I'm watching the debate. Maybe, hopefully you had something better to do for 3 hours last night. I'm watching the debate, and I'm watching Twitter as well, because I'm, you know, constantly doing show prep, and I'm looking for stories, and I'm looking for clips to play on the show, and I knew that people would be tweeting clips out. I don't know how you capture video and then immediately put it in your tweet and send it out. And I know somebody's going to email me a how-to thing on that. Don't do it. I'm not going to learn how to do it. It's too late. And I'm not going to have the passwords to do it anyway. But these people, as soon as somebody says something ridiculous, there's a tweet with a video on it. Like, how the hell did you do that so fast? Moreover, at the end of the debate, they put together a montage of Joe Biden's kind of senior moments. Is that a way to say it? Is that politically correct? His brain farts. It's probably more accurate. His stutters, his stops. They weren't as bad as the last time. I gotta give him that. Again, he stepped up his game a little, but when you're in the basement, there's nowhere to go but up. So just for fun, here's a little quick hit montage of just a few of Joe Biden's kind of senior moments from the debate.
Because we further support the ability with to dealing with the whole. Excuse me. And so I, you know, I looked at it anyway. That's what I think. My fact is that the bills that the president, the future president here, that the senator
say that we need a realistic plan. Here's what I
really didn't say that.
I didn't say we needed a realistic plan. Have you met me? I'm Joe Biden. I don't say I need a realistic plan. I know some of you will email. That was just a taste. That was just a small taste. I know. And some of you have emailed me in the past when I've made fun of Joe having these brain farts, saying, you know, he grew up being a stutterer, and that could have, that can account for some of it. But for referring to Cory Booker, who he was calling there the president, and then he said, oh, the future president, that's not a stutter. When somebody says, you said we needed a realistic plan, and you say, no, I didn't say that, that's not a stutter. I can give you the beginning there, but the end and the middle, not so much. But like I said, it was still a better performance for Joe Biden than it was in the first debate. So kudos to him. All of his debate prep paid off eventually, slightly, a little bit. Actually, before we get to the actual debate clips, yesterday we played the debate clips and then we did the analysis from the media. I want to play one little clip because this tells you how corrupt and the media is and how dishonest they are. All you got to do is tell the truth. That's not too much to ask. Jennifer Granholm was the governor of Michigan. She's a Democrat. She's always on TV. She is allegedly a teacher at a college out in California. I forget which one of those high-paying ones. It's telling that after her two terms as governor of Michigan, she had to leave the state to find work because she didn't do a very good job. But still, Chris Matthews, I remember once fawning over her saying, oh, if only you were born in the United States, you could run for president, because in the liberal side of the world, you fail upward. No matter how bad you are, you just keep getting promoted up. And very few people have failed as well and as thoroughly as Jennifer Granholm. But sadly for the people of the United States of America, she was born a filthy, rotten Canadian citizen. So thank God we don't have to deal with that. Anyway, she had some thoughts on the debate on CNN afterwards. And then when it's done, I'll tell you why CNN is such a dishonest hack organization.
I think that collective sound of sighing you hear are the sighs of relief of people in the Democratic Party who wanted Joe Biden to show up. And he did. I know there were a couple of rough moments, but honestly, his opening was sharp. His closing was sharp. He had a great response, I thought, to Bill de Blasio, the sort of fourth moderator, about the TPP and trade. And he came forth in a strong way. And in a state like Michigan, that was really important in terms of whether he would support NAFTA 2.0. So I thought Joe Biden did a great job tonight. And I, you know, we'll see what happens in September.
So there you have on CNN, right after the debate, Jennifer Granholm, former governor of Michigan, saying she thought Joe Biden did a great job. Oh, boy, howdy. His opening statement nailed it. His closing statement was spot on. His closing statement, he screwed up a line that he's been delivering on the campaign trail since he got on the campaign trail, saying that 4 years of Trump is an aberration and eight more years. He said eight more years, and then he gave out a text line as a web address. He seemed lost by the end. Whatever they'd given him, the little bump of coke he had backstage had clearly worn off by then. But Jennifer Granholm still said, even though he completely fumbled his closing, that he did a great job, and the Democratic Party establishment, of which she is a part, breathed a huge sigh of relief. Oh, yes, we can all go to bed tonight on our 2,000 thread count sheets saying that Joe Biden, all is right with the universe because Joe Biden did a great job in the debate. Now, nobody challenged her on that assessment. You can't really challenge somebody on their opinion, even though that's what cable news exists to do now, rather than convey facts. But they also didn't point out an interesting fact about Jennifer Granholm. And this is where journalistic integrity comes into play, or should come into play. You go back to a Politico article from just 2 days ago, 3 days ago. So it was July 29th. The headline on Politico is, he realizes now that he screwed up. Biden scrambles to recover from debate flop. The subheadline, even the former Veeps supporters wonder whether he can exercise the discipline necessary to execute a debate plan Wednesday. And you scroll down, you scroll down, you scroll down, and you get to middle of the story, and you see this paragraph. And pay attention, because there's a name. There's a name that will sound very familiar in just 1 second in this story. So there was little evidence that the prep work that went into Biden's first debate appearance, preparations that drew on the talents of former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, Anita Dunn, who helped prepare Barack Obama for debates, and Ron Klain, who served as top debate preparation advisor to Presidents Obama and Clinton and nominees Al Gore and John Kerry and Hillary Clinton. Boop, 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 boop. Stop. Wait a second. You said Jennifer Granholm, Derek. Yes, I did. You see, this story points out that one of the debate preppers for Joe Biden's campaign is none other than Jennifer Granholm. So there she is, working with the Biden team, trying to get him some energy, trying to get him to be more alert, be more responsive, be better at responding to attacks. One of those people on the payroll, likely, even if it's not on the payroll, it's horribly unethical, is there on CNN giving their opinion that is presented as though it's an unbiased opinion. This is just my honest take. Here's what I'll tell you. I thought that the guy that I'm paid to help did a great job. Really? No, that's not what was said. You heard what was said on CNN. Jennifer Granholm could have been out there still. All they had to do was say, Governor Granholm, you were actually on the debate prep team for Joe Biden. Now, you don't work on somebody's debate prep team unless you're a political hack that is for hire, which is entirely possible for Granholm. But what's more likely is the second option, that you are on board with that campaign. You are a supporter. You are an endorser. You are all in on them. You've hitched your wagon to them. And more likely than not, you're looking to get some sort of cabinet post out of the deal should that person win. Wildly unethical for CNN to not admit that. And there's a possibility CNN didn't know. I mean, they're not really a news organization. It might not have come across in a Democratic Party press release, so maybe they didn't pay attention to it. But Granholm should have. And once CNN was alerted to this, they should have come on and corrected the record. They did not. There was, I can't imagine at that point, because this went around social media a little bit, and CNN people are very active on social media. So the odds of nobody there having heard about this or having any idea about this are pretty slim. Yet it just went out. There she is. So if you're watching at home and you see CNN and you're for some weird reason, probably because you didn't live in Michigan, a fan of Jennifer Granholm, you think, and you have respect for Jennifer Granholm, you think, oh, if she thinks that Joe Biden did a great job and nailed the kickoff and the landing, well, then maybe I have to go along with Joe Biden, because I didn't really think about it that way. But now that somebody I respect says it, it's something completely different. That's why disclosure matters. It's much better to just throw everything out there, especially when you're giving your opinion. If you give people, look, I work with this guy, so obviously I think he did a great job, but I really do think he did a great job. There you go. You've avoided the ethical conundrum. But that's not how CNN works. That's not how Jennifer Granholm works. That's not how Democratic Party politics works. All right, let's get into the debate itself, shall we? And since we're talking about Joe Biden, let's talk about Joe Biden. Like I said, I thought he did okay for what he had to do. I'm never going to vote for the guy, but I thought he did okay. That being said, the problem with Joe Biden's 50-year career or whatever it's been in public service, in air quotes, is that over the course of that long-ass career where you've never actually worked in the private sector, you say a lot of things, you hold a lot of positions. There are little things that you could stick them on. Kirsten Gillibrand tried to nail Joe Biden on there's an op-ed you wrote in 1981 that says that women shouldn't work outside the home. That's not actually what the op-ed says. She was quoting from the title, and anybody who's ever written an op-ed can tell you, you don't get to pick the title, especially in newspapers, certainly not in 1981. He was, and I don't want to go off for too long defending Joe Biden, but he was writing an opinion piece against offering subsidies to people making $100,000 or more for childcare. That was what it was. How the editors decided to frame the headline was not up to him. Doesn't matter. Still, Joe Biden should have been able to answer it better than he did. But one thing that he did catch hell on, and we'll have a clip of Biden and Gillibrand, because Gillibrand came at Biden and Biden. Actually, I'll just play, because this is one of the highlights for Joe Biden. This is one of the good moments for Joe Biden. During this attack, this is exchange with Kirsten Gillibrand, senator from New York, and currently polling at -7 or something like that. I can only imagine it's going to go down after her performance. He blasted her because she is trying. Kirsten Gillibrand is running on the fact that she's a woman. It's basically all she ever says. If you've ever heard any of her campaign stump speeches, if you follow her on Twitter, if you've seen any interviews with her, she talks about she's a woman, she's a woman, she's a woman. Like, yeah, we get it. Your name's Kirsten. You're there in a dress. Again, I guess none of that really matters in the Democratic Party. Maybe she does need to clarify to Democrats. Maybe I'm thinking about this all wrong. To hell with it. So she's been trying to blast Joe Biden as a woman on behalf of women. Joe Biden is a horrible sexist because in 1981 he wrote this op-ed. By the way, hysterically on CNN, Kirsten Powers, maybe it's just a Kirsten thing, went off on Kirsten Gillibrand about bringing up something from 1981, saying Joe Biden, his opinion clearly has changed since 1981. Are we really going to go back to 1981 and look at everything anybody said or did back then? Kirsten Powers and everybody on CNN did exactly that when it came to Brett Kavanaugh. Just a reminder. It wasn't 1981, though. I think it was 1983. Maybe 82 is the cutoff. I didn't know. Anyway, while Kirsten Gillibrand is attacking Joe Biden for being a horrible sexist, a closeted horrible sexist, Joe Biden shot back with something. Again, this is politics is a very, very small world. When Joe Biden is vice president of the United States or has that cachet and you're running for re-election, as Kirsten Gillibrand did, you campaign with someone like Joe Biden. You go around and you say nice things about them. If you're bringing out somebody to sort of be a character witness to your constituents, they're going to come out and speak on your behalf. You build them up as a wonderful person. You're not going to say, and coming next to the stage, this worthless pile of crap who's got some name recognition, hopefully he'll get me some fundraising dollars, but I don't trust the guy. He plays grab ass with my staff in the back. You're not going to introduce anybody like that. Joe Biden pointed out how Kirsten Gillibrand brought him around New York and sang his praises for his work with women. She didn't have much of a response to this.
Very beginning, my deceased wife worked, but we had children. My present wife has worked all the way through raising our children. The fact of the matter is, the situation is one that I don't know what's happened. I wrote the Violence Against Women Act, Lilly Ledbetter. I was deeply involved in making sure there were the equal pay amendments. I was deeply involved in all these things. I came up with the It's On Us proposal to see to it that women were treated more decently on college campuses. You came to Syracuse University with me and said it was wonderful. I'm passionate about the concern making sure women are treated equally. I don't know what's happened except that you're now running for president.
So I understand. Mr. Vice President, I respect you deeply.
It's not often you capture the dying moments of a campaign, but that's likely the dying moments of Kirsten Gillibrand's campaign. You're anti-woman. You don't like women working outside the house. You wrote in 1981 that it's destroying the family. You want to explain yourself? And he lists off all this stuff. And then he says, you know, you praised me not that long ago. And the only thing that's changed is you're now running for president. And the crowd erupts. Kirsten Gillibrand isn't the most likable person in the world to begin with. So it was a pretty easy shot. But I thought it was perfectly executed. He didn't stumble over anything. He laid it all out there. He set it up, set the ball on the tee, and crushed it down the fairway. So that was probably his shining moment of the debate. And that's really kind of all it takes, is one really good moment where you win over the crowd for that moment. Because people remember zingers, you know. That's the weird thing about politics. It's part of why I make so many jokes during this show. I just think of them on the spot. I can't really control what comes out of my mouth, although if I focused, I could probably keep myself from doing it very NPR style. But God, I would not listen to that. So I wouldn't inflict that on anybody. But I find that, you know, from elementary school on down, they're cheesy and some of them are dirty, surprisingly. But you learn jokes as a kid. And for some reason, they stick with you. The reason they stick with you is because it's engaging a lot of parts of your brain. When you laugh, it's a good time. The endorphins go. I think that stuff gets into your brain and stays in your brain much longer than any dry, boring lecture from anyone, anywhere, at any time. I think you just zone out and you miss all of that. It goes in one ear and out the other. At least I know it does with me. But if somebody's telling a joke, I can remember jokes from elementary school. I can remember jokes much better than I can remember almost anything else. And I remember almost anything else pretty well. So that moment is going to stick with people for a while. All right, now we get to the other parts of Joe, because it wasn't all rainbows and sunshine. They went all in. They did like they did yesterday. They did like the first 45 minutes of the debate on healthcare and how everybody wants to ruin healthcare. Then they went to, I think it was climate change next or immigration, some sort of grievance thing, whining and whining and whining. And on the climate change issue, they are all convinced that the world is going to end in 10 years. And as a reminder, there is no scientific consensus on any of this crap. This 12-year number was made up by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, literally just made up. And they've all adopted it because they're lemmings. Well, in the course of that discussion, Joe Biden made, I won't call it a gaffe, he made a statement that is very similar to what Hillary Clinton said in 2016, and this helped lose her coal country, which lost her West Virginia, which lost her eastern Ohio and western Pennsylvania, and ultimately both of those states. If Joe Biden becomes the Democratic Party's nominee, and the Trump campaign does not have this as a campaign ad on constant loop in those areas and any place else where fracking or energy production happens, it will be political malpractice. Listen to Joe Biden from the debate last night talking about the future of energy.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Just to clarify, would there be any place for fossil fuels, including coal and fracking, in a Biden administration?
No, we would work it out. We would make sure it's eliminated and no more subsidies for either one of those, either any fossil fuel.
No fossil fuels whatsoever. No, we're getting rid of coal. We're getting rid of fracking. Many states, including my own state of Maryland, have screwed over people on the fracking front. There are a lot of people who could make a lot of money, like, you know, not F me money where I'm willing to screw over myself, but certainly F you money where I'm willing to screw over myself a little bit to piss you off, because they're sitting on large natural gas deposits. And the best, most efficient way to get it, and the only cost-efficient way to get it in most cases, is fracking. And the state of Maryland says, no more fracking. Fracking is horrible for the environment. And you say, well, what are you basing that on? And they said, well, I just feel it in my bones. Or this left-wing documentary is what I'm basing it on. It's amazing the power that the left has to infect every aspect of our lives. They do it very smartly. Check out the documentaries on Netflix sometime. Every liberal cause under the sun is there with some you know, so-called documentary. They're not documentary. They're propaganda films. They probably owe Leni Riefenstahl royalties for stealing her shtick. But they're presented as documentaries. And when people hear documentaries, they think, well, this is just the truth being presented and I can make up my own mind. Not how it works. Anyway, Joe Biden says he's going to get rid of coal. Well, there are a lot of people in western Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio and in West Virginia who work in the coal industry. These are hard hit areas. They're making a bit of a comeback now. So if you're in one of these areas or you know anybody who works in that industry or even tangentially in that industry, Joe Biden is basically saying, yeah, I'm going to screw you over. I'm going to do it in the name of this new religion that we've created called climate change. And everybody must be a true believer. And if some people have to be sacrificed, hey, man, you know, we're going like the Native Americans in Central America who used to commit human sacrifices. So we're just getting back in touch with our roots. It's all good. We're going to sacrifice these people. You can't create utopia without breaking a few eggs. But if you get in the Wayback Machine, you don't even have to go all that far back. In an interview in 2012, while then Vice President Barack Obama was looking for votes in coal country, and they actually got them, he was interviewed a local television show, a station, and he said the following.
Look, it's all of the above for us. We desperately need coal, and we need it to get cleaner and cleaner. We desperately need all the sources of energy.
We desperately need everything. We need it to get cleaner and cleaner, but we're on board. I'm wanting all of the above. Remember, the Obama campaign ran on the all of the above energy policy. Now, just a few short years later, no, we're going to eliminate coal. We're getting rid of coal totally, totally and completely. How well do you think that's going to go over? That helped Donald Trump significantly win Pennsylvania. In Ohio, he won by a lot more, but definitely in Pennsylvania. He won West Virginia on a landslide because Hillary was so anti-coal. She promised a bunch of coal miners, yeah, no, we're going to eliminate all coal jobs, but don't worry, we'll teach you how to code. You can suddenly, at age 45, learn to program computers. And most people were sitting there going, what in the hell planet are you from, woman? Well, Joe Biden's making the same mistake because in the Democratic primary, you've got to run so far to the left. There really is no way to pull up from that nosedive. He endeared himself to the environmentalist wackos with his we've got to eliminate coal stuff. He will turn them off. The true believers who are convinced, you know, they're building bunkers now. They're building arks for their family and their cats and dogs and gerbils. Don't ask what they did with the gerbils. So they're building all these. They believe that this flood is coming, that the end of the world is near us, and we've only got 10 years to do it. And if he tries to pull back from that, then they're going to be disheartened because they're true believers. The people who believe in climate change, man-caused climate change, really believe it. They are full blown all in cannonball to the deep end of the pool without even checking the temperature or even if there's water in the pool. And if you pull back from a promise like that, because that was music to their ears, you're done. You're done with them. Not that they're going to vote for Trump, but many of them will not vote. So that's a good thing for Republicans there, because they were all on board with this. He wants to build 500,000 charging stations for electric cars because they want to replace every car in the country with an electric car by 2030. That's not realistic. Cars last a long time. Cars are expensive. But the government will try, if Democrats get control, to force you to buy a new car. They'll probably do a cash for clunkers kind of thing, which really didn't accomplish much except for driving up the price of used cars. Why? Because they bought used cars, government. So you give us your used car, we'll give you X amount of money for it. And they didn't put that in the secondary used car market. They ground them up. They crushed them into squares and then sent the wreckage over to China, and they're going to build it into weapons probably. But the cash for clunkers, that's all it really accomplished. is getting rid of a whole bunch of used cars. And now you used to be able to buy a car for $400 or $500 a clunker. Now you get, you know, $1,000, $1,200 for a clunker. We always had a philosophy, or not a philosophy, a little saying when it came to cars. If it rolls, it's worth $500. If it rolls, it's worth $500. If it ran, it was worth more. So you can always make an old car run again, but not anymore, because the government took them out of circulation. Scarcity increases price. That's just a fact. All right, who else was up on that stage? I talked about Kirsten Gillibrand. She was really just insufferable. I mean, maybe I don't like her because I think she's an awful person. She was very close to the Clintons. She positioned herself. She sidled up to Hillary and Bill. They helped her get Hillary's seat when Hillary became the Secretary of State. She was perfectly willing to suck up to the Clintons. And then when she became this force of feminism during the Me Too movement, she denounced Bill Clinton, said he should have resigned. It's an outrage. He was horrible for what he'd done to Monica Lewinsky. And I'm thinking, you didn't have a problem having him at fundraisers. You didn't have a problem palling around with him. She also used to work at the law firm that represented Harvey Weinstein and helped quiet some of the more salacious rumors, in air quotes, about him. So she actually worked on it. There are many pictures of her and Harvey. Harvey was a big supporter of hers when she got to the Senate. It's good to have friends in high places. So when she claims to be this champion of women, you got to kind of keep things in perspective. So that kind of pollutes my opinion of her. That's probably why I have a low opinion of her. It's also doesn't hurt that she's just a creepy fraud who used to be pro-Second Amendment and pro-life when she was representing a Republican district as a Democrat in a Republican district. And then when she went statewide, she flip-flopped on everything. And says, well, I was just wrong before. She was first, you know, I don't know if she was pro-life, but she was definitely pro-Second Amendment, and she was definitely pro-border security and deportation of illegal aliens. Now all of that is gone. Now she is so desperate, because she's polling down next to nothing. Most people don't know who the hell she is, and they're lucky for it. She's polling down next to a rounding error, certainly closer to zero than the margin of error in any poll puts her. So she was asked about race. Well, she wasn't asked about race. She wanted to chime in on it. And she wants to become president, or at least the nominee, so she can travel around the countryside lecturing whitey about how good they've got it. Doesn't matter the situation, doesn't matter the circumstance, how poor you grew up, how hard you've got it now, what your job is, if you're a coal miner, for example, doesn't matter. Whitey, you got it really good, and she's going to lecture you, she's going to get on her high horse, and hi-ho silver around the country, lecturing people about white privilege.
So I don't believe that it's the responsibility of Corey and Kamala to be the only voice that takes on these issues of institutional racism, systemic racism in our country. I think as a white woman of privilege who is a U.S. senator running for president of the United States, it is also my responsibility to lift up those voices that aren't being listened to. And I can talk to those white women in the suburbs that voted for Trump and explain to them what white privilege actually is. That when their son is walking down a street with a bag of M&Ms in his pocket, wearing a hoodie, his whiteness is what protects him from not being shot. Has a car that breaks down and he knocks on someone's door for help and the door opens and the help is given, it's his whiteness that protects him from being shot. That is what white privilege in America is today. And so my responsibility is to not only lift up those stories, but explain to communities across America, like I did in Youngstown, Ohio, to a young mother, that this is all of our responsibility.
It's all of our responsibility. She got cut off there at the end, but I love that. If I can travel the country as a white woman of privilege and lecture whitey about how good they've got it. Take that campaign down the Appalachian Trail. See how well that works over. Having grown up in Michigan, take that campaign anywhere outside of the greater Detroit area or Ann Arbor, where the University of Michigan is, and see how receptive the crowd is. Just go ahead, travel just for the hell of it. See how that works out for you, Kirsten. Yes, she's, of course, the first one. If you walk down the street with M&Ms in your pocket and you're wearing a hoodie, your whiteness is the only thing stopping you from getting shot. She's referring to Trayvon Martin, who was shot after attacking George Zimmerman. That was pretty well established by the cuts from concrete on the back of his head and the beating his face had taken. How he got there, George Zimmerman, the world's first white Hispanic, which again didn't exist till George Zimmerman came along and Democrats found it politically advantageous to create that, had nothing to do with police. But she wants you to believe that that's a common occurrence, that just walking down the street while black gets you shot if you got a hoodie, and it was Skittles, not M&Ms, that Trayvon had. That's, of course, a total and complete lie. I couldn't even call it an oversimplification because it's so ridiculously absurd. Yet that's what she's selling. This rich white woman. She's rich and she's white. She also tries to portray herself as very young. I think she's 53 years old, but she calls herself a young mom all the time. And I'm like, no, you're not a young mom. I think my mom had grandkids by then. But she's just insufferable. I don't know how. New York has to be the dumbest place on the planet, not just the city, but the state. The city's dumb enough to elect Bill de Blasio, the mayor of the city, but to then double down on it and elect Kirsten Gillibrand to the United States Senate. Like, there are millions and millions of people in the state of New York, in the city of New York. This is really the best you could do? This is it. This is the cream of the crop. And I know, you know, the cream rises to the top, but sometimes crap floats too. And I think that's likely the case here, because the trifecta, the other senator from New York, is Chuck Schumer. So something's going on there. Maybe they've got thicker water. Maybe it's salt water that things float in. Maybe it's heavy, heavy salt water. Okay, I wanted to play that. Later on in the debate, by the way, Kirsten Gillibrand talked about how she's the majority breadwinner in her family and the primary caregiver to the children, caretaker of her children, which makes me wonder what in the hell her husband does. He just does his crosswords and sits in the bathroom and cries about the mistake he made when he asked me to marry him. Maybe that's what he does. I wouldn't blame the guy. Okay, the other big moment from the debate was the clash. See, Kamala Harris, and according to the CNN focus group afterwards, they gathered together eight Ohioans, or Iowans, I guess they're called Iowans, to talk about the debate. I don't understand why eight people can tell you nothing except for their opinion, and their opinion is not really indicative of anything other than their opinion, but you got to get a really large group. But they did it, and they said that Kamala Harris came off as horrible during this debate. She was not very good. After the first debate, everybody was fawning over Kamala Harris, California senator. Oh, my goodness, did you see Kamala Harris? The way she attacked Donald Trump, or not Donald Trump, the way she attacked Joe Biden on busing. Oh, you know, he was against busing, and Kamala Harris was bussed. And, you know, this is an outrage that she said that if it were up to you, I would not have been that little girl that was bussed to them schools. And then it turns out after the debate that Kamala Harris has the exact same position as Joe Biden did on busing. The federal government shouldn't be bussing around, but if school districts want to do it, that's fine. If states want to do it, that's fine. The federal government shouldn't be involved in it because some places don't want it, don't need it, whatever. They're handling it in different ways. That's Kamala Harris's position. That's Joe Biden's position back when he was working with those horrible, horrible segregationists that got everybody all bent out of shape. Well, this time, she did go after Joe Biden quite a bit. Kind of. At a certain point when you're just going, remember the Mueller hearing? Because I got a couple of emails, and even my dad called me. And at the end of it, when Republicans kind of stopped asking their questions. They just took a little bit of their time and they praised the hearing and thanked Robert Mueller for being there because he seemed confused. He clearly didn't know that much about his own report. It was exposed, essentially, that he wasn't that involved in the investigation. After Republicans had scored all their points, they started pumping the brakes, or at least took their foot off the gas. They let it go. They didn't keep hammering on Robert Mueller like they could have. They could have kept dogpiling on him, but they thought, you know, I'm just not going to do that. I thank you for your service in Vietnam. You're a hero. You served this country as FBI director. That's all the time. That's all I have to say. And then they would just move on. That was smart. There comes a point of diminishing returns when you're pummeling somebody. When you run up the score, this was my problem with the Women's World Cup, the first game when they played Thailand or whatever it was, and they beat them 13-0. And when they score the 10th goal, they celebrate like they just won in double overtime. And then they score the 11th goal, and they celebrate like they just cured cancer. And at a certain point, it's just, it's embarrassing. And you start to feel sympathy for the team that's getting pummeled. That was kind of what Kamala Harris was up against last night, because all she did was attack Joe Biden. And at a certain point, Joe Biden, you know, he gave back a little bit, not a whole lot, but he gave back a little bit. At a certain point, you start to look bad. It's like, okay, just stop attacking that person and tell me what you want to do. Leave that person alone. The audience develops sympathy for the target of constant attacking, especially when they're not hitting back. It won't be a problem in the general election because the president will always hit back. So Kamala Harris was on the offense most of the debate. Then came Tulsi Gabbard, Florida congresswoman, military veteran of the Iraq war. She decided that she'd already said after the last debate that Kamala Harris does not have the temperament to be president of the United States, to be commander-in-chief of the military, and she would know she's in the military. Gabbard took the opportunity to pummel Kamala Harris on her record as attorney general in the state of California. You would think under normal circumstances, but these are not normal circumstances, but as a normal human being, which is why you're likely not going to vote in the Democratic primary. The idea of law enforcement is a good thing, right? You're a normal person. Your neighbors like to be safe. People like to be secure. They like to make sure that criminals are hunted down and arrested and justice is brought. Yet for the Democrats, for a party that talks about we need this kind of justice and that kind of justice, they never talk about criminal justice except in terms of criminal justice reform, meaning going easier on prisoners. Democrats have convinced themselves that our prisons are filled with nothing but people who were serving a 10-year to life sentence for jaywalking. That's not the case. Even the nonviolent drug offenders generally plea down, get rid of the weapons charge. Look, the prosecutor just wants to clear this case. If you plead to possession with intent to distribute, you can get 15 months and we can save a trial and you're not really facing 15 years for carrying a weapon or firing a weapon or whatever the case is. That's how most of these cases go. And they end up on paper being nonviolent drug offenders. Yet they're in there for a very specific reason, and it doesn't have to do with nonviolent drug offenses. It usually has to do with violence. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Kamala Harris, as prosecutor, should be able to run on her record. Look, I protected the people of California. Don't email me. I know she wasn't a great attorney general. It's California. I'm just making a theoretical argument. Instead, she can't. Because Democrats hate police, they hate prosecutors, they hate prison, they hate anybody going to prison. They don't think that anybody should be held on any kind of bail or have to come up with any kind of bail, no matter what the offense is. They want them charged and released to then go out and inflict themselves on the rest of society yet again. So her record as a prosecutor and as attorney general, prosecutor in San Francisco and attorney general in the state of California, is a bit of a hindrance to her. It's a problem. Well, Tulsi Gabbard brought up her record, which really hasn't been all that exploited and exposed and written about. And she absolutely pummeled Kamala Harris with her record, going through it piece by piece by piece. This is a little bit of a montage. We cut out the guffaws from the audience and the applause. I think there's a lot of people that don't like Kamala Harris in the audience, mostly Biden supporters. But listen to this absolute virtual pummeling of Kamala Harris by Tulsi Gabbard.
Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president, but I'm deeply concerned about this record. There are too many examples to cite, but she put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana. She blocked evidence that would have freed an innocent man from death row until the courts forced her to do so. She kept people in prison beyond their sentences to use them as cheap labor for the state of California. And she fought to keep cash bail system in place that impacts poor people in the worst kind of way. When you are in a position to make a difference and an impact in these people's lives, you did not. And worse yet, in the case of those who were on death row, innocent people, you actually blocked evidence from being revealed that would have freed them until you were forced to do so. There is no excuse for that. And the people who suffered under your reign as prosecutor, you owe them an apology.
It was absolutely brutal, and she had a highly ineffective comeback. She had not much of a comeback at all. I don't think she was prepared for that much, and she certainly wasn't prepared for it to come from Tulsi Gabbard, but come it did, and she was stunned. And that moment stuck with her. That moment stayed with her like a cloud of stink, like a fart in an overcoat, just dragged around with her for the rest of the debate. And I don't think people got over it. I don't think people got past it. You're dealing with a Democratic Party that is Antifa, that is Black Lives Matter, not exclusively, but they are a large percentage of the Democratic Party's faithful who will come out and vote in the primaries because they hate anybody who isn't like them enough. These are the people who are chanting pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon, and what do we want? Dead cops. When do we want it now? The person who put, as I don't think most people realize, that Kamala Harris has a history as a prosecutor. I don't think that's really been covered all that much. She talks about what she wants to do, and we would need to have a conversation about this, that, and the other thing. But she has a fairly extensive and fairly bad record, particularly if you're anti-law enforcement, and it's never really been explored. Tulsi Gabbard came out and just laid it out there for the world to see. And Harris, in an after interview with Anderson Cooper, was asked about this, whether or not she was prepared, whether or not she was shocked, whether or not she thought it was fair. Her answer was less than stellar. You can tell it was still stinging. Her answer was basically, look, I'm in the top tier, so of course I'm going to be attacked by peons. What is she at 1%, 0% in the polls? She's desperate. I'm paraphrasing, but here, listen to it for yourself.
Do you expect that from Tulsi Gabbard? Had you had interaction about that in the past, and how went?
Well, I mean, listen, this is going to sound immodest, but I'm obviously a top-tier candidate, and so I did expect that I would be on the stage and take hits tonight because there are a lot of people that are trying to make the stage for the next debate.
Yeah, for a lot of them, it's do or die.
Well, yeah, and especially when people are at 0 or 1% or whatever she might be at. And so I did expect that I might take hits tonight.
Look, I'm up at the top. She's near the top. She's barely in mid-double digits, so it's not like she's got, anything to brag about. And she's been dropping. She's dropped 8 points in the last month. So I'm not really sure I'd brag about my polling there, but hey, you know what? You do you. Still, that left a mark. That was stinging, and that's something that is going to haunt her. It's something that's going to cause problems for her. In the future, she's going to have to find a better way to deal with it than say, look, somebody's coming at me, they're a peon, they're just a gnat, so what do I care? She doesn't actually address the substance of the allegations, likely because she can't. And to say that I thought that I would get attacked, if that was your best response and you thought it was coming, that's pretty damn pathetic. But it was a good moment for Tulsi Gabbard. That we got very excited. She was the top trending, top search on Google afterwards, which again, yesterday it was Marianne Williamson. Doesn't really mean anything at all. Might be a bump in fundraising. It might help her make it to the next round of the debates. But in the grand scheme of things, Tulsi Gabbard is still crazy. I know there are some conservatives who think that Tulsi Gabbard is the cat's meow. Like, oh, she's a force. She's something to be reckoned with. They're isolationists. Nothing wrong with being an isolationist per se, but that's not enough to get me to consider voting for somebody. And I know Tucker thinks Tulsi has Tulsi on all the time, sings her praises because he's an isolationist. She's an isolationist. She's also a suck-up to Assad, Bashar al-Assad, in Syria. She traveled over to Syria, toured Aleppo after Assad had committed war crimes there, and had no problem basically becoming his mouthpiece in the United States. I personally have a problem with that. Also during the debate, as if to put a fine point on how just so crazy she really, really is, because you think, oh, she sounds kind of sane sometimes or whatever, what she's saying. Listen to what she says about Trump. She says that he supports Al-Qaeda. What's telling here is that the subject is dropped. Upon hearing this, literally, that's almost a direct quote, a sitting member of the House of Representatives and a current presidential candidate for the Democratic Party accuses the President of the United States at the end of this of supporting Al-Qaeda. And there is no follow-up like along the lines of, what the hell are you talking about? Nothing. CNN, this is CNN, they just move on. The rest of the stage, they just move on. They just pretend that this woman did not accuse the President of the United States of supporting a terrorist organization that was responsible for 3 million American murders on September 11th.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. I would like to bring in the person on the stage who served in Iraq, Congresswoman Gabbard, your response to what Vice President Biden just said.
We were all lied to. This is the betrayal. This is the betrayal to the American people, to me, to my fellow service members. We were all lied to, told that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, was working with Al-Qaeda, and that this posed a threat to the American people. So I enlisted after 9/11 to protect our country, to go after those who attacked us on that fateful day, who took the lives of thousands of Americans. The problem is that this current president is continuing to betray us. We were supposed to be going after Al-Qaeda, but over years now, not only have we not gone after Al-Qaeda, who is stronger today than they were in 9/11, our president is supporting Al-Qaeda.
Thank you, Congresswoman.
Let's talk about Iran.
Right there at the end. So if you see Tulsi Gabbard on with Tucker and you go, oh, you know what? She seems actually kind of sane, a little bit of a moderate Democrat. Right there at the end, the president supports Al-Qaeda, and Don Lemon steps in and just goes, hey, thanks, Congresswoman. Let's move on from something else. Like, no follow-up? Really? No follow-up at all. Just going to let that slide right by. So remember, she's crazy. It doesn't matter what she says in a 5-minute interview with a host who isn't really going to go at her on the things they disagree with. What she says then doesn't matter. What she says here matters. If you believe that Donald Trump is actively aiding Al-Qaeda, then I think you've got your candidate right there in Tulsi Gabbard. But if you are not of that school of thought, then you probably should stay far away from her. It seemed like there was a lot of speculation on Twitter, like from the Twitterati, the blue checkmark brigade, that Tulsi Gabbard was really basically just auditioning for a role as Joe Biden's vice president. She carries far too much baggage. If you really learn about Tulsi Gabbard and her close relationship with Assad in Syria, a guy who has gassed his own people on multiple occasions, if you look into that, there is no way in hell Tulsi Gabbard will be anybody's vice presidential pick. Nobody is going to, you cannot have, first of all, she's from Hawaii. The Democrats have Hawaii sewn up. There's no reason to look at somebody from Hawaii. Secondly, she's a pretty close terrorist sympathizer. Isolationism aside, she tends to fall on the side of totalitarians in the Middle East. It's weird. I don't claim to understand it. And I just, I'm not judging her. She's been to war. That can do strange things. I don't know if she was crazy before, but she's definitely crazy now. Speaking of crazy, Cory Booker was up on that stage. I found him to be mostly a non-entity throughout the entire thing. The one person I didn't hear as much from as I wanted to, but I thought we definitely heard more from than the last debate when he got less than 3 minutes of speaking time, was Andrew Yang. Didn't matter what the question was, Andrew Yang was going to bring up the fact that he was offering $1,000 per adult per month to every American in the country. He keeps hammering that. He's kind of a one-trick pony on that. And I was disappointed because I like the concept of Andrew Yang. Not that I like his policy proposals. But if you go to his website, he has a solution or a proposal for everything. Vacant malls around the country, because, you know, malls are, he's got a solution for that. Circumcision, he's got a position and a solution for that. There is almost nothing that Andrew Yang hasn't laid out a detailed policy position on his website. I recommend, just for fun, you go to Andrew Yang's website. I think it's Andrew Yang 2020, or would I just look up Andrew Yang, and it should be right up there near the top. I appreciate somebody who puts out what they want to do, no matter how crazy it is. If they stand by it and believe it, I have a certain amount of respect for that. If they don't flip-flop, if they're not constantly changing, if they're not trying to pander nonstop, depending on who the audience is they're talking to. And that's why I have a problem with Kirsten Gillibrand and Kamala Harris and Cory Booker. They seem like they are more interested in finding out what the audience wants to hear and giving it to them in a non-committal way so that maybe they can come out with a few donations and some applause. And that's slimy and sleazy and political, creepy politician kind of stuff. I don't get that from Andrew Yang. Unfortunately, you don't get much else from Andrew Yang either. I'd love to, he almost, a lot of you email me, you need to have Democrats on the show. It's not for lack of trying. I came close to getting Andrew Yang on the program, at least if his press team is to be believed in the email exchanges we had, but it just didn't work out. I would love to get him on the show. I'd love to have a conversation with Mayor Pete. I'd love to have a conversation with any of these people. It's just that they're unlikely to be willing to set foot in the offices of the Daily Caller because they go, ah. I'm used to talking to Chris Cuomo and Don Lemon, where, you know, tic-tac-toe is too confusing for them. And they're not going to come into anybody who's going to challenge them. But back to Booker. During the debate, he's so desperate to seem edgy. The one thing that everybody kept saying about him in post-debate analysis on television was how likable he came off. I don't find likable to be a likable trait in somebody running for president of the United States. I want vision. I want principles. None of these people have any principles. They have no respect for the Constitution. They're arguing about how we've just got to take health care away from everybody because we can do better for them. What if they don't want it? Doesn't matter. We know what's better for them. That's arrogant and dangerous thought. But Cory Booker kind of slipped a swear word in the debate. And did it rather casually. Let's listen.
Senator Booker, please respond.
Well, a couple things. First of all, Mr. Vice President, you can't have it both ways. You invoke President Obama more than anybody in this campaign. You can't do it when it's convenient and then dodge it when it's not. And the second thing, and this really irks me because I heard the Vice President say that, if you got a PhD, you can come right into this country. Well, that's playing into what the Republicans want, to pit some immigrants against other immigrants. Some are from shithole countries and some are from worthy countries. We need to reform this whole immigration system and begin to be the country that says everyone has worth and dignity, and this should be a country that honors for everyone. Don't let the Republicans divide this party against itself.
Senator, don't let the Republicans divide this party against itself. See, he snuck in a shithole countries there. Donald Trump calls some places around the world shithole countries. All presses are stopped, and it's an outrage for a week. Cory Booker casually drops it. And it's an applause line in a Democratic Party debate. What's wrong with the idea of prioritizing people with PhDs coming into this country legally over somebody who doesn't speak the language, has never been immunized, God knows what they're a carrier of, and how are they going to be able to support themselves because they have no money? Cory Booker and most of the Democrats say, come on in, Mr. PhD, step aside, please. You go to the back of the line, Mr. You got your education on. Ooh, aren't you cool? Well, a PhD might be able to add something to this country, and that is the question we should be asking anybody who wants to immigrate to the country. It should be, what do we get out of it? What do we get out of it? Not, come on in, the water's fine. No way. That's what the Democrats want. Just, hey, what we really need is more domestics, more future domestics, more hired help. Those lawns of ours are not going to cut themselves, and we sure as hell don't want to pay a prevailing wage. So come on in. You sit down, Mr. Productive PhD. And that's Cory Booker in a nutshell. I don't see why people thought he was so affable, why he was so nice, why he was so friendly. I found him to be an arrogant douche, but that's just me. I know his life story. He portrays himself as this hard scramble. He said he was born into a civil rights family. Both of his parents were executives at IBM, highly paid executives at IBM. He went to elite schools throughout his entire education. He went to Yale Law School. I think he went to Oxford. He's not really had a hard scramble life, but he says, you know, I live in a poor neighborhood in Newark. Yes, you're a poverty tourist, Corey. You're a poverty tourist. That's different. It's like that book Nickel and Dimed that was wildly popular like 20 years ago about a reporter who went undercover as a waitress to see what it was like to be poor in America. Like, you're not really poor in America, because if you can pull out the Amex or your debit card or whatever when you're really, really hungry and you just say, all right, I'm done with this experiment, I'm going to go buy a hamburger, it's fake. You're not really experiencing what it's like to be poor. What it's like to be poor when you're in that situation is, what do I have that I can sell, that I can put gas in my car and eat for a couple of days until the check comes in? Or do I have any ramen noodles left? Because that's my only option. These poverty tourists drive me nuts. Finally today, I just want to play the way the gaffe that ended the show. This is what made Jennifer Granholm's statement about how well Joe Biden did and how he really nailed his closing statement. This is how Joe Biden didn't nail his closing statement.
If you agree with me, go to Joe30330 and help me in this fight. Thank you very much.
Go to Joe 3, and he looks like he's struggling, like closing his eyes a little bit, thinking, please just remember what we memorized. Please just remember what we memorized. And I think, if I'm guessing right, he gave out the text line for the campaign instead of the website. But he gave out the text line as a website, or as part of a website. I think he wanted people to text Joe to 30033. I didn't know what the hell he was doing. I thought he was like giving out, go to Joe 3030. And like, Joe, you're not going to be around for the 3030 election, but I appreciate the spirit, you know, that can-do attitude of somebody who can't tie their shoes. Good for you, Joe. So yes, Jennifer Granholm, oh, he nailed it. He nailed that closing. No, he didn't. He really didn't. Poor Joe. Still, I think he'll be fine. They'll all likely be fine to one degree or another. They're all rich. They're all elected officials, except for Andrew Yang, who's just rich. That is all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Email me, Derek@DailyCaller.com. We'll be back tomorrow with our weekly interview, surprise guest. And it's a media expert scheduled. Shouldn't have probably said that. Now it'll jinx it, but we shall see. Also, don't forget to stop by our sponsor, Life Change Tees website at getthetea.com. In any event, thank you for listening, and be back here tomorrow for another exciting episode, a Friday episode tomorrow.
I'm obviously a top-tier candidate.